Hello, this is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315. Today's interview is with Alvin Plantinga, Emeritus John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He is known for his work in philosophy of religion, epistemology, metaphysics, and Christian apologetics. He's considered by many to be the primary catalyst behind a sort of contemporary renaissance of interest in the philosophical defense of Christianity. Dr. Plantinga's books include God and Other Minds, The Nature of Necessity, God, Freedom, and Evil, Warrant and Proper Function, Warranted Christian Belief, among many others. And his most recent book, released in 2011, is Where the Conflict Really Lies, Science, Religion, and Naturalism. The purpose of this interview is to learn more from Dr. Plantinga, as well as asking him some questions submitted by Christian apologists and getting his advice for those defending the faith. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Plantinga.
It's my pleasure.
Well, many have credited you and your work as a catalyst of sorts of a recent renaissance in the philosophical defense of Christianity, and you've certainly made a profound impact on many. So first off, I just want to thank you for your faithfulness and your labor in that area.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your kind words.
Well, first off, I'm just curious about your Christian life as well as what interested you in the area of philosophy. Would you mind talking a bit about your background and what your influences were?
Well, I was brought up in a Christian home. My father and mother are both Christians, both members of the Christian Reformed Church, which is sort of transplanted Dutch Calvinism. And so I always thought of myself as a Christian as I was growing up, but then during adolescence, maybe when I was 14 or 15 or something like that, 13, the whole Christian story sort of came alive and felt like more my own story as opposed to something that belonged to me as opposed to something I'd heard. So it wasn't like knowing that China is a large country, but knowing something that was very important to me, sort of, and alive and salient. And my Christian faith has been important to me in that way, I guess, ever since, with ups and downs, as with most other Christians, dry periods and so on, and other non-dry periods. But basically, that's what it's been. Nothing very special about it, you know, sort of an ordinary meat and potatoes Christian life, but that's what it is.
Well, maybe some people are interested in what or who inspired you to become a philosopher, or if there may be other philosophers of old that sort of gave you motivation in that area.
My father was a professor of philosophy and psychology, and in his first job in Huron, South Dakota, also religion and Greek and sociology. I mean, that college had only like 12 faculty members, so they had to be real generalists. At any rate, he was a professor of philosophy, and I heard a lot about philosophy from him growing up. And when I was, 10 or something like that, he started teaching me Latin and trying to teach me Greek, and we'd read Plato. Maybe I was 12 when it came to reading Plato, but I sort of always thought I was going to be a philosopher. I briefly considered being instead a pastor. But I think I made the right choice. I don't think that would have worked nearly as well.
Would you say that if you didn't go into philosophy, that would be a possible area you would have gone into then?
I might very well have done that. Right. I don't know. I guess those are the only two things I really at all seriously considered, being a professor of philosophy and being a pastor. But I would probably not have been a very good pastor. Probably would have bored people by telling them about philosophy.
Well, you've done work at such a deep and profound level in dealing with arguments, say, for the existence of God, and some might be reminded now of a paper you wrote about a dozen or so theistic arguments. So my question is, are there some other powerful, maybe neglected theistic arguments that you would like to see worked on, or do you have any favorite forgotten arguments you could share?
Actually, that paper is called Two Dozen or So Good Theistic Arguments. It's got twice as many as you thought. And I don't know. I mean, one that I think is of particular interest is the argument from evil. There is an argument against Christian belief or against belief in God from evil, the so-called problem of evil, which gets a whole lot of ink and chapter I've written on myself. But I think there's an argument for belief in God from evil, too. I mean, evil strikes us as something something like a kind of, well, it's hard to say exactly how to characterize this, but evil isn't just something we don't like or that we think doesn't contribute to human welfare or something like that. It's got a deeply offensive feel to it. And it feels like, it feels sort of like going against explicit directions of somebody who's got a right to direct you in a certain way. It's got that kind of deep, serious evil. It's got a kind of personal feel to it. As when you think about, for example, the story in Sophie's Choice about the Nazi functionary who gave a woman, made a woman choose between which of her two children should be sent, should be freed, and which should be sent to the gas chambers. There's something about that that just seems so so deeply and personally wrong. It kind of feels like it just goes against the grain of the universe. But it can't be going against the grain just of the universe. I mean, the universe doesn't have moral convictions or a moral status at all. The only way really to understand the depth and power of evil of that sort, I think, is to see it in terms of rebellion against God, someone choosing to act specifically against what God, the way in which God intends us to behave. I mean, I think this is an argument that remains to be really developed. But I think it's a very promising one.
Would there be any others that stick out in your mind as far as being ones that you'd like developed in that same way?
Well, there's also the argument from abstract objects, from propositions and properties, states of affairs. These things, on the one hand, say a proposition like all men are mortal, not the sentence all men are mortal, but what that sentence expresses, and what would be expressed also by synonymous sentences in other languages. On the one hand, there's the intuition that these propositions are, that these things are necessary, they necessary beings. They couldn't fail to exist. It could not have been that there should not have been, it could not, it just couldn't have been that that proposition should not have existed, that all men are mortal, or that 7 plus 5 equals 12. It could be that nobody had uttered that, nobody had ever asserted the proposition or thought of it, but it, no human being, but it couldn't be that it just didn't exist. That on the one hand. There's also an intuition to the effect that propositions are sort of like thoughts. They seem to be somehow the sort of thing a mind does. They seem to be dependent on mind in a way. But the only way in which those two things could both be true would be if propositions are something like divine thoughts. Propositions would be among God's thoughts. God exists necessarily and thinks these thoughts necessarily, so the propositions exist necessarily, but they are also mind-dependent in the sense that what they are divine thoughts. And this would be kind of a development of a way of thinking about abstract objects that goes back to St. Augustine.
I want to ask you about the ontological argument real quick. Now, I've heard some apologists say that the ontological argument isn't one to use on the layman, but would you agree? And if not, how would you present an ontological argument in an easy-to-understand manner?
I would agree the ontological argument is not a good argument to present to a layman. In fact, I don't think it's a very good argument. It's an interesting argument, and it's interesting to think about it and see its connection with other things, but I don't think it's a good argument in the sense of something that's likely to convince anybody. So I wouldn't try to convince somebody to be a believer in God by the ontological argument.
Well, if you wouldn't use it, say, on a layman, how would you try to describe it to a layman so that he could understand it in a simple way?
I don't think there is any. I mean, the ontological argument, at least in my version of it, depends on a certain kind of feature of the metaphysics of modality, which I don't think somebody who hadn't studied some philosophy would be much interested in. I mean, that's the way in which it's not very accessible. Unlike, say, the fine-tuning argument or the argument for morality. So the ontological argument, I think it's I think it's a sound argument. That is, it has true premises and a true conclusion, but I don't think it's one that one could explain to a non-philosopher very well. And once you really see how it works, then I think you also won't think it's terribly convincing, because the premise and conclusion are too close to each other, you might say. So I would say the ontological argument doesn't have to be part of the apologist's toolkit.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you are out at the park, say, and you're speaking to a friend about life, and the conversation rolls around to spiritual things, I wonder how you would, you know, personally tend to go about sharing your faith. What kind of arguments would you tend to go to, say, in an everyday conversation?
Well, I'm not terribly inclined to think that people believe in God on the basis of arguments. I think arguments are useful to respond to objections to Christian belief or to belief in God, but I don't think very many people believe in God on the basis of arguments. I think C.S. Lewis said maybe that he did, and possibly Anthony Flew did at the end of his life, but I don't think that's the way it ordinarily goes at all. Somebody hears the gospel being preached and just finds it appealing. Just thinks, yeah, well, maybe that's the way it really is, you know. And the more they think about it, the more it seems that is the way it really is. So, if I were talking about my faith with someone who wasn't a Christian, I wouldn't try to argue them into belief in God or belief that Jesus is the second person of the Trinity or anything like that at all. I would just tell them how it looks to me. You know, I'd say, well, here's how it seems to me. It's extremely important to me, and here's how I think about it. And then let them draw their own conclusions.
If someone were to ask you, how can they be sure that God exists if they have doubts, what would be your manner in kind of approaching that sort of a question?
I guess I don't actually believe in God myself on the basis of arguments. It just seems right to me. But that doesn't mean that arguments aren't of any use in that kind of connection. I think they certainly are. I mean, arguments can sort of shore up one's or confirm one's belief in God. So like a fine-tuning argument can, for example, or the moral argument or other arguments of that sort. But I don't think that there is any particular argument that convinces me that God exists, just as there isn't any particular argument that convinces me that there's been a past or that there are other persons. The first book I wrote was, the title is God and Other Minds, in which I claimed and tried to show that the existence of other minds and the existence of God are in the same epistemological boat, as I put it. I said there aren't any really powerful arguments in either case, although there are maybe better arguments for the existence of God than for the existence of other minds. But nonetheless, clearly the belief in the existence of other minds is perfectly sensible, sane, rational, reasonable, excellent, and whatever. So maybe it's the same way with the existence of God, that one doesn't need arguments for it in order to be entirely within one's epistemic rights, in order to be rational, and the like of that.
What would you say about the statement that the existence of God is a self-evident truth?
Well, I'd say that a self-evident truth, that's the kind of truth like 2 plus 1 equals 3, or if all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. That is a truth that you can just see to be necessary, like it couldn't possibly be false under any conditions. I don't think belief in God is like that. I don't think it's self-evident in that sort of way, the way in which mathematical and logical, simple mathematical and logical truths are self-evident. But I would prefer to say that it's more like it's a basic belief, that is, one that doesn't, or a properly basic belief, one that doesn't require to be believed on the basis of arguments or on the basis of evidence from other things you believe. Just like, say, belief in other minds or belief that there's been a past.
Is there any sort of evidence, then, that could possibly convince you otherwise, that God does not exist?
Well, I don't know. I can't think of any right offhand, just as I can't think right offhand of anything that would convince me that there has not been a past. Contemporary physics does kind of crazy things with time, and maybe, who knows, maybe contemporary physics will come up with the idea that there hasn't been a past, but I still wouldn't believe that there hadn't been a past. I would think that physicists have just got that wrong. So I can't think of any evidence that would convince me that God doesn't exist.
Well, I was fortunate enough to be able to glean some questions from some fellow apologists, so I'm going to also be relying on some of their contributions. But interestingly enough, a number of people wanted actually to find out whether or not your air conditioner is working. Are you aware of that sort of question floating around?
Yeah, sure, right. Yeah, right. In my book, Warranted Christian Belief, I talked about the Aquinas-Calvin model, the AC model, like air conditioning, the AC model. And I also talked about proper function. My epistemology involves the notion of proper function. So I got this note from Bill Craig saying, is your AC model on the blink, or has it started functioning properly again? And I got a lot of other email along the similar lines. So, my air conditioning is probably okay, but since it's around freezing here in Michigan this time of the year, I'm not that interested in it.
Well, thanks for that. Quentin Smith wrote some time ago that you've had an enormous impact on the philosophical community, and subsequently the trends have been towards less and less secularization. How would you assess your own influence in light of his gracious comments, and what would be your observations about the philosophical community's sort of shift towards respecting theism? Do you think that Smith is overstating the trend, or roughly right, maybe?
Quentin was talking just about philosophy, not about the academic community generally. Well, I guess that's what you're asking about, the philosophical community. I think he's right in that there has been a substantial shift from, say, when I got my PhD, you know, when I got out of graduate school, my first job. At that time, there weren't very many Christian philosophers around, and the ones there were very low-key. They didn't... They sort of kept their heads down pretty much. The general attitude was the same as that of the chairman of my first philosophy department, whose name was George Nechnikian. He thought that, he said something like, he didn't think any intelligent person could possibly be a Christian. And I think that's what lots of people thought, and lots of people think that now too. But now there are lots and lots of Christian philosophers around. In particular, lots and lots of younger Christian philosophers. So there's several journals. There are about five journals in the philosophy of religion now, and most of the articles in them are written by Christian philosophers. At that time, there weren't any journals, as far as I can remember, in philosophy of religion. So there's been a substantial change along those lines. It's really kind of amazing. So he was saying that philosophy has become unsecularized. All the other disciplines were safely secularized. Quentin himself is a secularist. All the other disciplines were, and philosophy was too, but then it got unsecularized. So now there are all these philosophy journals, and not just the ones in philosophy of religion, where there are articles about God and about people being created in God's image and so on. The whole thing has come, from this point of view, come unstuck. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, though I think he exaggerates a little bit. I think he said something like a third to a quarter of philosophers in the U.S. would be evangelicals, or maybe a third to a quarter were Christians, and most of them would be evangelicals. That seems to me a little high. I saw some other poll that said something like 17% of philosophers were Christians, and maybe 22% of philosophy graduate students were Christians. Maybe that's a bit more accurate.
Well, you mentioned a lot of those Christian philosophers being younger philosophers, and here's a question from one of them asking, if you had to prescribe five or fewer philosophers that up-and-coming philosophers ought to read who would they be?
As for Christian philosophers, I would describe ones he probably knows, like Nicholas Wolterstorff and Richard Swinburne and William Halston and Peter Van Inwagen and Eleanor Stump and others. I mean, the list could go on. When it comes to non-Christian philosophers, I guess my favorite two 20th century non-Christian philosophers would be David Lewis and Roderick Chisholm, the late David Lewis and the late Roderick Chisholm. I think both of them are terrific philosophers.
I have a question about how Christians can be better thinkers. We were talking there about up-and-coming Christian philosophers and things, but I'm interested in Christians being better thinkers, just full stop. And when I look at good thinkers, I wonder if there are disciplines or skills that one can practice beyond, of course, their natural gifting in order to be a better thinker. So I'm wondering, are there any tips or skills that have helped you over the years just to be a better thinker in general?
One thing that I think people have to learn when they first get into philosophy, students and so on, that philosophy, you have to take it slowly. You have to subject what you say and what you think to careful scrutiny and try to imagine objections to it. Or you can imagine, if you're writing a paper, imagine someone looking over your shoulder, some philosopher whom you really respect, you know, and say, well, what do they think about this next thing I'm writing? But beyond that sort of thing, I don't really know that there are. It's a matter of practice and of finding out, you know, when you make mistakes and then avoiding that particular mistake and maybe other ones like it and so on. But that's about the best I can do.
Here's a question about your own personal studies and whether or not maybe you have a regime that you follow. For instance, if you tend to read slowly or if you speed read or do both, do you have a reading routine that maybe you follow or what influences your reading choices?
Well, when I was a graduate student at Yale writing my dissertation that year, my wife had a job as a teacher. And she would, we would drive in together to New Haven. We lived about 9 miles outside of New Haven. And she would drop me off at the library, Sterling Library, and, she would go and do, you know, go to her teaching job. And I'd get there about 8 o'clock, and I was supposed to work on my dissertation. And, the whole day would stretch before me sort of like really long. And I would sometimes get started doing something else, like, reading some magazines in the reading room or reading philosophy journals or reading science fiction. And sometimes this would go on. I mean, the longer I did it, the more guilty I felt. Here's my wife. You know, she was teaching and supporting me, at least in part, and here I'm just fooling around in the library not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And that was a real problem. I kept feeling more and more guilty, and the longer this went on, the more guilty I felt, and the more guilty I felt, the less I felt like actually getting to work. And I found years later, I found the answer to this. And that was not to require of myself that I work at something really hard, like a dissertation or a paper I'm writing the whole day, like from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. or whatever, but rather just to think, okay, I'll work hard just in the morning. In the afternoon, I'll do something else. And that's what I have done ever since. I work in the morning at whatever I'm writing or whatever project I'm working on along those lines. In the afternoon, I do something else, like teach, or the 1 year I was at the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences, where I didn't have any duties except just to have lunch. That was the only duty one had at this Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences. So I'd come in the morning, and I'd work till lunch, then I'd have lunch with other fellows in that center. That was a requirement of the job of that fellowship. And in the afternoon, I would answer my mail or go down and see what was going on at Stanford. This was on the Stanford campus, and go for a walk, actually in those days I'd go for a run. And that worked a whole lot better for me.
So what about your choices in reading? What influences how you approach your reading and choose one thing over another?
Well, sometimes I read something just because I find it really interesting. It might be on a topic I'm really interested in, or it might be by a philosopher whom I think is really terrific. So I run across a piece by say, Nick Walterstorff, well, I'd like to read it, you know, just because it's Nick Walterstorff. Or same for, you know, the other ones I mentioned, Benenwagen, et cetera. Other times I'm working on, or this would be the most usual thing, I'm working on a particular topic, so I want to read stuff on that topic. But ordinarily there will be a ton of stuff on that topic, and I can't read it all of it. If I do read all of it, I'll never get to actually writing anything on it. And I usually already have ideas on the topic, and I read these other things partly to test the ideas I've got on the topic. So what I do then is I just pick a few articles or a few books, parts of books, by people that I think are good philosophers, people that I really respect and read what they have to say, and don't read all the other stuff. I probably miss stuff I should read that way, but it still seems to me that best way to proceed there.
What would you say makes a good philosopher, and are there particular character traits that you see that are consistent with good philosophers?
Well, if you say, now, what sort of character traits should a Christian philosopher have? I would say several, but one would be kind of humility. I mean, there are two that are a little bit contrary to each other. One would be humility. I think philosophers in general, maybe this is just a problem with philosophy, or maybe even just with academics and Christianity, not so much with, well, I mean, Christian philosophers, Christian academics. There's a real tendency towards a sort of intellectual arrogance among philosophers, and I think among academics generally, though I don't know as much about other areas as in philosophy, but I think there is this tendency towards arrogance, which is, I find in myself too, namely, well, philosophers spend their whole, I mean, their job is thinking and trying to think straight. So they very often see what other people think, people who aren't philosophers, as kind of confused or, you know, not really worth looking at in any detail. This can be a real hazard to the Christian life, because there's a whole lot that academics, philosophers can learn from people who aren't academics and philosophers. Very often they fail to do so just because of this attitude. I'm thinking, for example, about like going to church. You go to church, the minister, maybe among other things, verges on some philosophical topic and doesn't do as good a job as you could do. If this leads you to adopt a kind of attitude of a patronizing attitude or something like that, you're going to be the worse for it. I mean, the point of a sermon isn't to inform you about philosophy. The point is to do something quite different, and it can do that even if the person preaching a sermon doesn't know as much philosophy as you do. It's a problem, I think, that I know that some philosophers have this problem, and I know some Christian philosophers who've actually stopped going to church just because they've got that problem. But it's a problem. I mean, the problem is with them. The problem doesn't lie with the preachers who don't know that much philosophy. So that's one thing. So on the one side, a kind of intellectual humility, or maybe spiritual humility. On the other side, I think Christian philosophers need something like courage. They have to be prepared to say things that the philosophical world as a whole is not going to approve of. They have to be prepared to do their own thing as Christian philosophers, and that can, in the present context, can require a certain amount of courage, a certain amount of being willing to be marginalized or thought not to be thought not to be quite up to snuff or something like that. I would mention those two.
Well, that's real helpful. Are there particular topics that you'd like to see Christian philosophers tackle in the future, and maybe what would a couple of those be?
Well, I think one topic that is an important topic right now and will continue to be is the whole problem of the relation of science and Christianity. Lots and lots of people seem to think there is a conflict there, and if there were a real conflict, I think that would be unfortunate for a Christian belief, because science is in fact impressive. So that's one thing, one area. More generally, I think Christian philosophers, I think they ought to try to think about the various kinds of problems philosophers have asked and answered from the very beginnings, from the pre-Socratic days, think about them from a specific Christian perspective. So it's not that a Christian philosopher is trying to figure out the answer to these deep questions like, is there such a person as God, or what's most important about human beings, or whatever. That's already given in Christian belief. If you're a Christian, you already know the answer to those. But what Christian philosophers ought to do, it seems to me, is look at all these other sorts of questions. Questions like, what is the nature of knowledge? Or how should we think about abstract objects? Or how does moral obligation work? Or a thousand others like that, the ones that philosophers ask and answer, as I was saying, from a Christian perspective, to see if there is a special way that, as a Christian, you should think about those things, or to see how Christian belief is, in fact, relevant to them. So those are the topics I would be thinking of there.
Mm-hmm. From your experience, what do you think would be your best advice to those doing apologetics?
Well, I guess I think of apologetics as having two parts: a negative part, responding to objections to Christian belief, and a positive part, which would be giving arguments for Christian belief or for belief in God. I think the negative part is extremely important, and I think the Christian philosophical community has done pretty well, too, with respect to that negative part. I think the positive part is a little more questionable, maybe, because, as I was saying, I don't think that people typically come to Christian belief by virtue of arguments. I think there are some pretty good arguments for the existence of God, but I don't think they are strong enough to support the kind of belief in God that a Christian actually has, or has if things are going right, namely a really firm conviction. Maybe as far as the arguments go, I guess I'd be inclined to say they provide some support, but they don't go far enough to support firm conviction in the existence of God. And then with respect to specifically Christian belief, incarnation and atonement and Trinity, that second person of the Trinity became incarnate and died, suffered and died so that we human beings could once more be in an appropriate relationship with God. I don't think there are good arguments for that. It's a tremendous story. It's an extremely appealing, wonderful story. People speak of it as the greatest story that has ever been told. I would think of it more like the greatest story that could ever be told. So if you ask, what would make a world a really great world? That incarnation and atonement, that whole story should be true in it, would be kind of an overwhelmingly powerful factor in what would make a world a really good world. But I wouldn't know how to really argue for that. Christians ordinarily, many Christians, for example, Reformed Christians who follow Calvin, speak in this context of the internal witness or testimony of the Holy Spirit, so that what leads you actually to embrace the great things of the gospel, as Jonathan Edwards calls them, would be God's sort of witness or testimony in your heart as to their truth. And Thomas Aquinas speaks similarly about the internal instigation of the Holy Spirit. So with respect to Christian belief, I don't think that's the way a couple people come to hold Christian belief. On the other hand, to refute arguments against Christian belief, I think that is extremely useful, because people very often are kept from Christian belief just because they've mistakenly endorsed some argument or heard some argument against it. And so I think positive apologetics or negative apologetics maybe has a bit more to be said in its favor than positive.
I want to spend a few minutes, just as we begin to wrap up, talking about your latest book called Where the Conflict Really Lies, Science, Religion, and Naturalism. And there in the preface, you say, my overall claim in this book is that there is a superficial conflict, but deep concord between science and theistic religion, but a superficial concord and deep conflict between science and naturalism. So I'm wondering if you could sort of unpack that statement a little bit and talk just briefly about your overall goal in writing your latest book here.
Well, my overall goal really, I guess, would be to argue for what you just said, that there is superficial conflict but deep concord between science and, say, Christian belief. But superficial concord and deep conflict between science and naturalism. So in the book, I start off by considering some of the areas where people claim there is conflict between science and Christian belief or theistic religion. For example, some people think miracles are incompatible with science somehow. Some people think evolution is incompatible with Christian belief, the belief that human beings have been created in God's image, for example. And I argue that those are mistaken beliefs. There isn't any conflict in those areas. There are some other areas where there is conflict, where scientific claims are inconsistent with Christian belief, for example, in evolutionary psychology. But then I argue in a certain way that that conflict is superficial. It's there, but it's superficial. And then I go on to point out that there's deep concord between science and theistic religion, in that science got its start in the context of, in the 17th century. The first modern scientists were almost all, as far as I know, serious Christians, or at least, as in the case of Newton, serious believers in God. Maybe he was a kind of heretical type of Christian. And they all saw science as a matter of figuring out how this world God has created, how it works, which seems to me to be the appropriate way for a Christian to think about science. And some of the basic presuppositions of science fit really well with Christian belief and not well at all with naturalism. For example, Christians think of God as having created human beings in his image, part of which involves having the ability to know things about God himself and about us and about our world. If you're a naturalist, you think human beings got here by virtue of natural selection working on random genetic mutation. You should be much less sanguine about the prospects of our investigation in the world. And if you don't think about something like God's faithfulness in upholding the world and making it the kind of place that is knowable. I mean, the world could have been really chaotic, you know, from a naturalistic point of view. It could have been really chaotic. It could be just one thing after another, sort of, with no real pattern, and not the sort of thing that a science could get any grip on. But it fits really well with Christian belief to think, well, since God wanted us to be in his image, and since he creates us in his image, and part of that is to have knowledge of our world, God didn't create the world in this chaotic fashion. He created it in such a way that it's got regularity and dependability, and hence knowability. And when you think about the applicability of mathematics to the world, which is very characteristic of science, hard sciences anyway, this is kind of amazing, really. Not amazing, though, if you think about it from the point of view of Christian belief of God's having created the world. So there is deep concord and superficial conflict. With naturalism, I think there is real conflict. And in the last chapter of this book, I give an argument that I call the evolutionary argument against naturalism, in which I argue that if you're a naturalist, if you're a naturalist who believes in evolution, you really get a defeater for the proposition that your cognitive faculties are reliable. And if you've got a defeater for that, then you can't really sensibly practice science. I mean, because if you have a defeater for the proposition that your faculties are reliable, you'll have one for any proposition, any belief that you come up with. And if you've got a defeater for any belief that you come up with, you can't in any sensible way practice science, at least if you think of science as a way of coming to know about the world. So I say there's deep conflict between science and naturalism, but that deep concord between Christian belief and naturalism.
You talked about one of the powerful arguments against naturalism being the evolutionary argument against naturalism, but I wonder what sort of arguments tend to be the main ones for naturalism, and how do you think they may fail?
I don't know if there are good arguments for naturalism. I think the best argument against belief in God would be from the problem of evil. But I don't think that's a terribly good argument. I don't know of any good arguments for naturalism. I think naturalism is more fundamentally like a religious conviction, a certain sort of basic stance you take towards the world. And just as I don't think there are any conclusive arguments for belief in God, and certainly for Christian belief, so I also don't think there are any arguments for naturalism. I don't know exactly how it happens that people become naturalists. I mean, I'm not too clear about that. I think naturalism isn't actually very popular among people over the world. The vast majority, maybe 9/10 or maybe more of people in the world, are believers in God or something like God. As for how the other 10%, if it's that large a percent, come to be naturalists, I guess I don't really know. But I don't think it's by virtue of any powerful arguments, because I don't think there are any.
Well, Dr. Plantinga, what do you hope your most lasting contribution is to the Christian community? You've written a number of books, and you've contributed a whole lot to philosophy. But what would you like to see come of your efforts in the long run?
Well, I don't really think a lot about that. I don't think people are very good at predicting the future or knowing what the actual results of our own efforts are. So I don't have any much by way of views on that. I just hope that, and I think this is to some degree actually happening, I just hope that there will be increasing numbers of young Christian philosophers who defend the Christian faith by means of philosophy, and then also engage in the sort of positive philosophy I was talking about, which we could follow Augustine and call a matter of faith-seeking understanding. Understanding the Christian faith in terms of philosophy by looking at the answer to these philosophical questions from the perspective of the Christian faith. But as for sort of more global effects of what I do or anybody else does, I leave that to the Lord.
Do you have any hints on what your next writing projects may be?
Well, I hope to do some of the things that I was working along some of the lines I was just talking about. For many years at Notre Dame, I taught a graduate seminar called How to Be a Christian Philosopher, in which we did exactly what I was mentioning a moment ago, try to look at various philosophical questions and problems from a specifically Christian perspective. And I think I learned a lot during the years I taught that course, and I hope to write some essays on some of these various different questions, and maybe if, I don't know how long I'll have to do this kind of thing, but maybe wind up at some point with a book of essays on those topics. That's what my project is.
Well, I know that it would be well received. Dr. Plantinga, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for taking the time to do this interview.
Okay, you bet.
I've been speaking with Alvin Plantinga, Emeritus John A. O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. Links to his books and resources can be found at today's blog post at apologetics315.com. This podcast marks about 100 interviews with Christian apologists, scholars, theologians, philosophers, authors, and other defenders of the faith. Do you have a recommendation for someone you'd like to hear interviewed? Perhaps suggestions on how to make the podcast better? Feel free to email your recommendations to interviews@apologetics315.com. Did you know that there are other podcasts by Apologetics 315? All in iTunes. Just search for Apologetics 315 in iTunes to find them. And they include How to Get Apologetics in Your Church, Logical Fallacies, Read Along with Apologetics 315, and a number of others. One thing that helps get the word out about resources like this interview is your help by sending links, tweets, and Facebook updates to your friends on the web. So if you found this resource helpful, please take a few seconds to share it. I also encourage you to be a friend on Facebook or Twitter for more daily links to the best resources and articles in Christian apologetics. Please pray for this ministry as it continues to grow. And if this podcast has been a blessing to you, please consider leaving a positive review in iTunes. This is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315, and thanks for listening.